This week's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast is brought to you by the Wind Up Watch Shop. In the Wind Up Watch Shop, you'll find an array of exciting, innovating brands offering watches that appeal to a wide variety of tastes and styles. From quartz watches with impeccable design and detailing, to one-of-a-kind mechanical timepieces with tech unlike anything you've ever seen before, the Wind Up Watch Shop has something for everyone. So head over to www.windupwatchshop.com. That's www.windupwatchshop.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the Worn and Wound podcast. On this week's episode, we have a twofer. In the first half of the episode, I'm joined by Worn and Wound contributor Zach Kazan, and we chat about one of his recent articles, Tariffs and the Watch Industry, How the U.S.-China Trade War Impacts U.S.-Based Watch Companies. And in the second half of the episode, I talk to Magnus Appelreid of Braver Watches. If there's something that you want us to cover on a future episode of the podcast, then be sure to hit us up via email at info@wornandwound.com. Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, this is Ilya, and joining me on the podcast today is Worn and Wound contributor Zach Kazan. Zach, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem, Ilya. Thanks for having me.
So on this episode of the podcast, we are actually going to talk about a story that you, Zach, wrote. The title of the article is Tariffs and the Watch Industry, How the U.S. Trade War Impacts U.S.-Based Watch Companies. Before we get into that topic, let's do a quick wrist check. So Zach, what are you wearing?
Sure. I'm actually wearing a Zenith Defy in black ceramic, relatively recent acquisition, and I've been wearing it pretty much every day for the last couple of weeks. Really cool watch.
Is it it's the one with like the slightly skeletonized dial?
Yep, it's got a skeletonized dial. I never thought that I would be interested in wearing a watch with a skeletonized dial, but for some reason this just kind of, I think it's the symmetry of I guess it's supposed to be like the Zenith star. They look like tuning forks on the dial of the watch. And it just, you know, it's more symmetrical than I think a typical skeletonized watch. It's a really cool, you know, sleek sports watch. It's really comfortable and lightweight, and I'm really enjoying it a lot.
It's a really, really great watch. It's actually one of my favorite in Zenith's lineup.
Yeah.
I was so surprised how much I liked it when I tried it on a Baselworld, I think 2 years back, because that's when they came out. Do you have any interest in some of the other watches that Zenith are putting out these days, or is this sort of like an outlier?
So this is the first Zenith that I've owned. I'd definitely be interested in owning an El Primero at some point, although I've kind of drifted away from chronographs and sort of started, you know, sort of being sort of obsessed with chronographs. That's what got me into watches in a way. But I would definitely, you know, try an El Primero at some point. You know, overall, I'm really satisfied with this watch. It's just really fun to wear. And I've always kind of, I think, been more interested in sort of like traditional watch designs. And there's something like really, you know, modern about the new Defies and Zenith's line. And so it's just kind of fun for me to have, you know, unapologetically modern watch to wear.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's such a big heritage push going on now, but it's always interesting to see a really exciting, modern, contemporary looking watch come out and one that people actually are drawn to. And you're not the first person I know who's picked one up. They're actually, you know, relatively popular, I would say, and not a lot of modern watches get that sort of love.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So cool. It's a cool watch to own.
So I am wearing my Nomos Orion. It's the date-free variant. Probably one of the more austere watches that Nomos makes. Maybe the Tangenta is one as well. But I just love how classic it looks. But at the same time, it also feels very contemporary.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like an old-school design. It does feel fresh.
Yeah, I love the Orion. I owned the 38mm Orion, and I kind of miss it. I sort of wish I still had it. But I love the long lugs. It's really beautiful, beautiful watch.
I do too. I know that a lot of people sort of dismiss the long lugs because it leaves a pretty big gap between the end of the case and the end of the lugs where the strap attaches. I've never really found that to be a problem. I think it looks really cool. It's the same sort of aesthetic that you find on the Nomos Club. And I know people had issue with that, but I just think it looks really cool. It elongates the case. It makes it look really sleek.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's a really cool watch.
Cool. So let's get to the topic at hand. So the idea for this article came to me when Bradley Price of Autodromo sent us this latest batch of List 4 tariffs. Now, obviously, the U.S.-China trade war is topical, but this latest batch of tariffs is interesting and relevant because it targets about $125 billion worth of consumer goods, and that includes watches. So going through the list, I saw that the tariffs get really, really specific when it comes to watches coming out of China. So I pulled a couple just to sort of show our audience like how specific they really get. So here's one. Wristwatches with cases of or clad with precious metal, not electrically operated, with automatic winding, with 27 joules or less in the movement. So that's one. Here's another one. Wristwatches with cases of or clad with precious metal, not electrically operated, not automatic winding, 8 to 17 joules, and the movement is over $15. It's kind of nuts.
Yeah, the list of tariffs that, I mean, if you can scroll through the list for days. It's just endless, you know, items. And, you know, if you've been, you know, anyone who's paid attention to the news or done any sort of research on their own on the tariffs knows just how hyper specific they are. And just looking at the watch related tariffs, you know, on their own, it really encompasses just about every type of watch you could think of. And then also all of the individual components on their own too, like the actual, you know, quartz crystals and, you know, the different raw materials that might be used to make other components. So, you know, definitely an impact on the industry for sure.
You know, we thought it'd be interesting to take a look at this latest round of tariffs and really explore the impacts that they might have on some of the brands that we cover on Worn & Wound, many of which are small US-based companies, and many of them rely on Chinese manufacturing for their production. And I know that when I pitched the story to you, you were really excited to take it on. And by the way, you did a great job with the story.
Oh, thanks.
When you first set out to write this article, did you have some maybe preconceived notions as to what you might write, and did it change in the outset? Because really what we were doing, we weren't really taking opinion on the tariffs. We were really just sort of exploring the effect that these tariffs were having on companies like Autodromo, for example.
So I was, you know, I try to go into these things without any, you know, real preconceived notions. I mean, obviously I have my own, you know, opinions on, you know, kind of the state of our politics and, you know, where we're at, you know, in the trade war. But I was interested in hearing what the folks that I corresponded with for this piece, what they had to say about how it specifically influenced, you know, the watch industry, and really what Bradley and Vishal had to say about their experiences, you know, in the watch industry, leading brands, and how these tariffs impact them on a day-to-day basis, or how they don't. And, you know, those two guys have you know, kind of different opinions on the impact of these tariffs. And I thought that was really interesting. So that was the sort of thing that I was most looking forward to finding out, you know, as I think, you know, maybe the strength of the article is kind of shining light on, you know, how the tariffs might impact different businesses in different ways, just depending on how the businesses are run.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So actually, let's talk about some of the people that we reached out to for this article. So we reached out to Reginald Brack, who's a watch industry analyst for the NPD Group. Mm-hmm. We talked to Anna Ashton. She's the Director of Business Advisory Services and Government Affairs with the U.S.-China Business Council. Mm-hmm. We talked to Bradley Price of Autodromo. And lastly, we talked to Vishal Talani, who is the Managing Director for Solar Time Limited and Dartmouth Brand Limited, which includes brands like Aviate, Spinnaker, and Dufa. And actually, Vishal is an interesting person to talk to. He runs a number of brands that manufacture in China and then export to the US, but he's also a manufacturer.
Right.
So he definitely has an interesting perspective on this whole thing, coming at it from both of those sides. When you talked to Reginald, what was his sort of take and what was going on?
So talking to Reginald was interesting. He, you know, obviously, well, let me just say he's the watch industry analyst for the NPD group, which is kind of a group that, you know, is really focused on the retail side of the watch industry. I mean, they provide a lot of data to, you know, to retailers in the state of the industry. And, you know, his contention was really that we'll have to wait and see and see, you know, how this kind of shakes out over the longer term before we know, you know, what's going to happen. He's not looking at it from the brand perspective, having to plan ahead for, you know, production runs, you know, potentially months or years down the line. So that was kind of the what I took away from my conversation with Reg.
He's not really seeing any impacts at large now, but that could change in the future, largely because he is mostly dealing with Swiss manufacturers, correct? And they're not really being affected by the way these tariffs are being put out.
Exactly.
But it was interesting to see that even the Swiss are definitely taking a sort of wait and see approach, because there is a degree of volatility with this trade war.
Right. I think that the retail markets are so, you know, intermixed. And if the larger, because when we're talking about the Chinese, you know, watch business and the manufacture of watches in China, what we're talking about really is, you know, watches on this, you know, enormous scale, like so many, you know, like inexpensive watches that, you know, are kind of like beyond the reach of what we cover with Worn and Wound, and certainly not, you know, what we'd call luxury watches. They're, you know, they're inexpensive watches.
So we reached out to Anna Ashton, and I actually had seen Anna on a couple of news programs talking about their trade war. She's sort of like a go-to person to discuss politics and the effects of the trade war. And she had some pretty interesting perspectives as well. And she definitely sees the trade war as a negative.
Yeah, absolutely. She's kind of the perspective that, you know, any additional, you know, tariffs on Chinese made goods are going to ultimately have a negative impact on the consumer. And that's really, you know, the point that she, I think, was kind of trying to drive home with me, is that, you know, no matter when the tariffs are implemented, is one of the things we talked about a little bit with her, was, you know, how this list is divided up and what tariffs go into effect in September versus later in the year after the holidays pass. And her major point was really that, you know, it doesn't matter, we're going to need to buy things, you know, before the holidays and after the holidays. And, you know, it's going to hurt you one way or the other, you know, as a consumer, when you actually, you know, go to pay for these items that have been hit with tariffs at some point.
Right. And I think it's probably important to emphasize, one of the reasons why we're looking at these tariffs specifically is that these are the more consumer facing tariffs.
Right.
So now that we kind of, you know, have the context for all this, let's talk a little bit about what Bradley Price said. So I know that this is something that's been a challenge for Bradley as far as his own company is concerned. He had a pretty negative take on how these tariffs would affect businesses like his, correct?
Yeah, I would say that he is not, he's certainly not pro-tariff. You know, he sees this as certainly driving up his costs. And I think he's concerned about, you know, driving up, you know, end costs at the consumer end at some point. So I think that was definitely a concern that he voiced.
Well, so he made a couple of really interesting points in his responses to the questions that we posed to him. One of the points was that, you know, a lot of people are being hit with tariffs now on orders that were put in months ago.
Right.
And when those orders were put in, people weren't necessarily prepared or calculating the possibility of being hit with tariffs on those items. You know, if you were planning for the next 6 to 12 months, the trajectory of your company, now that's sort of being thrown into disarray because of the tariffs, correct?
Yeah, so he kind of sees that, you know, the watches are coming one way or the other, and he has to make a choice, the brand has to make a choice, and I think he sees this as a, you know, kind of a universal decision that, you know, all brand owners are, you know, really need to make who do business in China, is that you either need to, you know, absorb the cost and take the hit in profitability, or increase prices at the consumer's end and just hope that they accept it. And, you know, obviously no one wants to, you know, you as a, I would imagine as a brand owner, you don't want to, you know, raise prices on your, you know, loyal customers who come back to you and, you know, do repeat business. But in order to, you know, to kind of meet that bottom line that he, you know, expects to meet or needs to meet and had planned to meet, that's a difficult decision that he has to make, and that other brand owners have to make too.
For sure, especially because I think there's a lot of volatility in this business for a brand owner like Bradley, right? You know, his product cycles might get thrown off because he got a bad batch of dials from a manufacturer, right? So that'll add another 3 to 6 months to his production timeline. Those are 3 to 6 months that he's not selling watches. And that's obviously eating into the money that he has on hand. I'm sure as a brand owner, he probably, you know, prepares for that. But then to have this on top of that, it's sure to create some difficulties as a small business owner.
Yeah, it's an unexpected expense. And I think that for any business owner, anyone running a company, you know, you have to, you, of course, you know, you expect a certain amount of unexpected, you know, expenses during the course of doing business, but, you know, it doesn't make them any less painful. And I think that he sees this as kind of a, you know, a pointless, you know, expense, as a lot of people kind of feel that way about these tariffs.
And I think the other point that he made about, you know, not necessarily wanting to raise prices on your consumer, as you know, as I know, as pretty much anyone in the space knows, prices are a very dicey topic, right? Like, once you set a certain expectation as to how much your watches should cost, going beyond that expectation could prove difficult for a brand.
Yeah, and I think the other complicating factor in the watches that we cover is that the trend is moving downward into, you know, watches becoming, you know, more affordable. You just look at, like, where, you know, like, you know, the ETA based GMT, I mean, they've gone down, you know, 50% in price. You know, a few years ago, those were, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 watches. And now they're, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 watches. So, and, you know, as more people get interested in the hobby and the business gets larger, you know, you would expect prices to come down, and you wouldn't, you know, if you're an Autodromo customer, it would be disconcerting to see a watch go up in price for something that's very similar. You want more value, not less, you know, in this price range, I think.
Did Bradley talk to you about looking for an alternative supply chain as a possible solution? Is that something that he's considering? Is that something that he's heard maybe other brands considering?
That's not something that we discussed specifically, but I would, you know, if I were a brand owner, I would certainly be, you know, open to looking at other, you know, other supply chains. If I thought that the, you know, the cost of doing business in China was going to get, you know, higher and higher over the course of time, you know, you just have to look at what's sustainable for your business, I suppose.
Thinking about where else a brand could go, I mean, there's not that many watch manufacturing hubs around the world, right? Like, there's sort of this burgeoning space in the American market, but I mean, that's they can't take on that capacity. And I think the Swiss are famously closed off. And, you know, we've heard recently from Ming Tian of Ming Watches that in the last couple of years, the Swiss have, in fact, opened up because more manufacturing has gone to East Asia. But still, it's not going to be that easy, I think, to crack the Swiss nut and get in there. China's such a significant point of manufacture now in the industry that I can't imagine, you know, there really being a feasible alternative at that scale.
And I think we've gotten to a point too where the Chinese manufacturers kind of know what they're doing and are producing, you know, really like high quality stuff. You know, you've made the point a number of times, and just in speaking with you, you know, about the American, you know, watch industry, there's, you know, obviously there's a lot of, you know, really fine American brands, you know, selling watches, but there's really no watchmaking infrastructure.
No.
Here, you know, it's not a simple thing to just produce thousands of watches for sale. You need to, you know, the equipment needed to, you know, to churn those out at scale is not, you know, it's not inexpensive, and it's not really even available to, you know, an American manufacturing. So I feel like a lot of the brands that we cover, for better or worse, are, you know, really kind of locked into that Chinese supply chain.
Exactly. And, you know, China basically is, at this point, when it comes to making watches, it's a well-oiled machine, and it's one that's been doing it for decades. So,
yeah, no, I totally agree.
Yeah. And the last person that I wanted to talk about was obviously Vishal. So Vishal had an interesting perspective, and it was actually a little bit unexpected, right? I kind of thought that Vishal would have some harsh words for the tariffs, being that he's based in Hong Kong. But Vishal had a really interesting perspective on this whole thing. And what was that perspective?
So I think Vishal is kind of, I get the sense from speaking with him that he does business at such a large volume, and he has his hands in so many, you know, brands plus the manufacturing business, that, you know, his feeling is that the retail side for his business is just much more important than the manufacturing side, and getting watches, you know, into the right channels to hit his customer base is really what drives his, you know, his business decisions on a day-to-day basis. He said in the article that, you know, he essentially can't really do anything about the tariffs. You know, he does business in China. There are tariffs and that's that. And he has to, you know, factor that into the way he does business, you know, across a number, as you said, a number of brands plus the manufacturing side.
He also had some pretty interesting thoughts about what the industry's other challenges are, right? And for him, the tariffs are sort of like a blip on the radar. It's really not that significant. He actually is more concerned about the general state of retail within the watch industry, correct?
Yeah, you know, from corresponding with him a little bit, that definitely seems to be his primary focus. He's really thinking a lot about how to get, you know, his watches into the hands of his customers and how to best sell them to his customers, what channels to use, using, you know, traditional e-commerce, brick and mortar retail, social media, and trying to find the right mix. And obviously, you know, as you know, he sells, you know, watches in a number of different, you know, categories, you know, different price points. And so it just makes it even more complicated for him, I think. I get the feeling that that's really the, you know, kind of the math equation that he's most focused on, because the tariffs, he can't really do much about that. But he has some flexibility in, you know, in how he sells, you know, watches on a, you know, quarter to quarter basis.
So what were some of your takeaways at the end of all of this?
You know, for me, one of the big takeaways is just like how big the Chinese watch market is, or the Chinese, you know, manufacturing component of the watch market. It's enormous. It affects the, you know, the entire industry in ways that we don't necessarily think about, or even ways that we don't even, you know, really know yet, as the watch industry continues to grow and get bigger. You know, I think Reg's point is really, you know, well taken, that we just don't know, you know, how these tariffs are gonna shake out across the larger watch industry yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Zach, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, absolutely. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to your next article.
Yeah, we've got a couple of good pieces in the works. So yeah, good things to come.
Do you want to give a little taste of one of the big ones that's coming up?
Well, I think pretty soon we have an article coming that's sort of a sequel to the piece that I wrote a few months back on the Lapinist, the Seiko case refinishing. It showed us a lot of the great work that he did restoring, you know, Seiko cases using Zeratsu polishing. We talked to a handful of prominent vintage watch dealers to get their take on the type of refinishing that he does, restoring watches to the appearance of new old stock condition. That sort of sparked a very, I'd say, healthy debate on the Worn and Wound Instagram. There's a lot of, you know, I think, very legitimate, you know, concerns from, you know, consumers about, you know, what being able to refinish a watch in that way, you know, means for the end customer. If there's, you know, an unscrupulous, you know, dealer who wants to take advantage of someone, there's, you know, opportunity to do that. So we talked to a handful of dealers who are definitely, you know, not unscrupulous and very well regarded, to get their opinions on that. And so that'll be coming pretty soon.
Cool. All right, Zach, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ilya.
Have a good one. Bye. Hey, everyone, this is Ilya, and joining me on the podcast today is Magnus Appelreid of Braver Watches. Magnus, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So our tradition on the show is to start every episode off with a wrist check, and you're our guest, so what are you wearing?
So I'm wearing our latest model called the Geography. It's a GMT watch with a second time zone. It was launched in the end of last year. So I'm wearing the one with a white dial.
It's a beautiful watch. Braver's known for, or at least I know Braver as a company with a really clear design language, and like that's a great execution of the watches you've come to be known for.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We work very hard on finding a balance between, you know, a minimalistic design and unique and interesting details.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, and you see a lot of like minimalist watches now, and they're sort of derivative. Yours aren't. Like, you have a very clear design language that you've kind of honed over the last couple of watches.
Exactly. We really try to find our own identity and find unique design elements that makes you recognize a Braver watch.
Yeah.
And again, we don't want to remove as much details as possible. We try to find a balance between the Scandinavian minimalistic design and and details, basically.
So I am wearing a watch that I actually picked up today. I traded some of my other watches for it, and this is the Fortis Cosmonauts Chronograph. This is a watch from the 90s, and this is the official watch of the Russian space program of that time. What's cool about this watch is that it has a Lamania 5100 chronograph, which is a pretty cool movement that you don't really see anymore because they don't make them anymore. But what actually makes this watch even more special is that the case is only 38 millimeters, and a lot of Lamania powered watches are a little bit big. It's a fun watch.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that we basically start every podcast off when we talk to somebody who's running a watch brand is, how did you get into watches? How did it all begin?
Well, it wasn't obvious that we would do watches. Mm-hmm. Brother was started by myself and my colleague Johan. We both have a background in industrial design.
Yeah.
We didn't have an interest in watches, actually. Okay. None of us. We've been friends for many years. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do something together, starting a brand. Mm-hmm. And for many years, we discussed what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was about to buy a watch for myself that we started exploring the watch market. Mm-hmm. And, see what was available, start thinking about what we could contribute with and mm-hmm. what we wanted to do. So it wasn't obvious at all. Mm-hmm. We were discussing many different products. We both have an interest in cycling. So we mm-hmm. discussed cycling-related products and everything. But when we began to think about watches, it was a really good product for us because we both have a big interest in fashion. Mm-hmm. So it's like a good combination of fashion and industrial design in a way.
Yeah.
It's a product you wear all day. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it was a really good product for us.
So when you were thinking about possibly doing watches, you were obviously shopping for a watch for yourself.
Right.
What were you seeing on the market that wasn't necessarily doing it for you? And what did you think like was missing that you could bring to the table?
We thought that most of the big established brands communicated a quite macho lifestyle mm-hmm. with, fighter airplanes and mm-hmm. Luxury yachts, cars and everything.
Yeah.
We couldn't quite identify with that type of lifestyle.
Right.
So we wanted to create a brand communicating a different type of lifestyle, mm-hmm. basically, something we could identify with, mm-hmm. more of an urban, fashionable lifestyle,
right.
I would say. We also felt that most brands had quite a diverse design style. Mm-hmm. So there were no unitary design elements.
Right.
Keeping all the collections together, so to speak. And we wanted to create a brand with a strong identity in the mm-hmm. design of the watches with unitary design elements.
Mm-hmm. From collection to collection.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So we have several design elements that we work with. Maybe we don't use all the design elements on every watch, mm-hmm. but it's still there in different shapes. Mm-hmm. So that was also quite important for us to create a strong identity in the design of the watches.
So when you finally decided that you're going to make watches, what was your first step? What did you have to tackle from the very beginning?
So we started in 2011.
Is that when you started or when the brand launched?
No, that's when we started working on the brand. And back then, it was not that common with micro brands. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest obstacles was to find a supplier that mm-hmm. wanted to work with us. A
right.
totally unknown brand, a new brand.
Yeah.
We had pretty high demands on the quality and what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So we were working like 2 years before we launched the first collection.
Mm-hmm. So in those 2 years, you were looking for manufacturers, you were working on the designs.
Yeah. Of course, we did design work, of course. And
right.
also, defining the brand and everything.
Yeah.
A lot of that time, we searched for suppliers. Mm-hmm. And we actually had to start from scratch twice.
Okay.
Because we started with a supplier and twice we had to restart and
what were the issues with those early suppliers?
We didn't get the quality we needed, mm-hmm. basically. So that was really hard for us.
Yeah. Do you feel like suppliers have gotten better since from the time that you started to now? Because that's what I'm seeing with like a lot of brands, I feel like the watches that they're producing are at such a higher level today than brands were producing even 5 years ago.
Definitely. I think so. And I think that when we started, most suppliers didn't see the value of working with a micro brand. Mm-hmm. But I think now they do.
Yeah. So why do you think that is?
I think they see some of the brands that has become really big.
Yeah.
So one of the examples, I wouldn't call it a micro brand, but Daniel Wellington. Mm-hmm. They started out really small and mm-hmm. now they're huge.
Yeah.
I definitely think a lot of suppliers are looking at how they developed.
Yeah.
And want to find the next brand during that trip.
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean, it makes sense because, you know, you look at some of the bigger Swiss brands or some of the more established brands, and year after year, you hear stories about whether or not the industry is healthy or it's not. It's going up, it's going down. Mm. Whereas you see a substantial growth in the micro brand market. And it makes sense for, you know, manufacturers and suppliers to really diversify and to really tap into all segments, whether it's they're making stuff for big brands or small brands. It would be silly to just focus on like the big brands because you don't know if that how successful that's going to be in the future, you know?
No, exactly. And the watch market has really changed a lot.
It's diversified incredibly.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So what were some of your earlier designs? What was the focus with your earlier watches?
So we started, as mentioned, we didn't have a background in watches.
Yeah.
So for us, it was most obvious to show the quartz movement. Mm-hmm. So the quartz movements offer, of course, a good value for money. Mm-hmm. So we started out with quartz watches. It made most sense for us. We didn't have to offer like service of movements and everything. So we did Swiss-made quartz watches to start with. Mm-hmm. But eventually, interest and knowledge in watches grew. Mm-hmm. We were more and more drawn to automatic watches or mechanical watches, of course.
And when did you make the shift to producing mechanical watches?
In 2017.
Okay.
And since then, we have shifted our sale from previously, of course, only quartz watches. Mm-hmm. And last year, we shifted to almost only automatic watches. Mm-hmm. So we have been able to make that shift.
Right.
And of course, the price level has gone up a bit. Mm-hmm. So you never know how the customers will react to that.
And what was the reaction on your end? Like, what did you see? Was there a pushback or did your customers kind of understand the bump in the price given the new movement?
Yeah, I think they understood it.
Yeah,
definitely. And a lot of people asked, when we only had quartz watches, people asked if we would do automatic models as well. So a lot of people were waiting for automatic watches from us, basically. Mm-hmm. But of course, we mainly sell online. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to know at what price level people buy on the internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's watches that you haven't seen live.
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean, obviously there's value in like seeing watches in person because you can really kind of get a sense of how it's going to fit, which is really important, but also the quality, which sometimes photos can be a little bit deceptive, you know?
Exactly, yeah. It's difficult to really communicate the qualities of the watch in images.
Yeah. So one of the things that you see a lot in the micro brand scene, obviously, is a lot of like Kickstarter watches. And with that, you get like Kickstarter pricing. Mm. I think like, given the quality of your watch and the fact that you guys are building a business, your watches are priced correctly. But does seeing watches that are priced at like $100, $200, you know, sort of like fire sale on Kickstarter, does that make things difficult for you guys to operate when you guys try to market your brand?
Yeah, I think it does. We want to offer a lot of value for money.
Yeah.
And I really think we do. But we have quite high ambitions. Mm-hmm. So we are very careful in the choice of materials.
Yeah.
Like the movements we choose, they are not the entry-level movements. Mm-hmm. We choose some of the finer movements to be able to make thinner watches, etc. And I'm not sure people always understand the difference in the pricing, of course.
Yeah.
And as mentioned, we want to offer a lot of value for money, but it doesn't mean that we want to be cheap. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like we're overpricing the watches, but we have high ambitions in the build quality, in the finishing, in the materials, and the choice of movements. Mm-hmm. And it all adds up, of course.
Yeah.
The competition has really grown a lot the last few years, definitely. And I think it's easy to look at the few brands that grow really fast. Mm-hmm. And I believe a lot of people want to make that journey and expect everything to go very fast. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't always do that. Mm-hmm. And I really think that it will pay off to have a long-term plan and not only focus on fast growth.
Exactly. It's like doing things right, doing it at a good pace to really build up your brand, build up your customer base, and really just think about the long-term rather than the immediate reward.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's very important for us. We try not to take any shortcuts.
Yeah.
And of course, it might take longer time to grow the brand.
Yeah.
But we think it's worth it.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your design process. So let's say you have an idea for a watch, right? How do you go about designing it? And then how long does it usually take for you to go from your idea of a watch to finally having like the product in your shop?
I would say it usually takes like 1 to 1.5 years.
Okay.
So it's a pretty long process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because Johan and I, we are both industrial designers.
Yeah.
But we complement each other mm-hmm. quite well. So we start with, like, one of us have an idea,
mm-hmm.
start sketching on it. The other one continues with it. And when we're done, we don't know who came up with what, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's really a mix of...
Both of your sensibilities.
Exactly, it is. So that's quite interesting because from the start, you have your own picture of how it will turn out.
Yeah.
But then when you end up... It's just a mix of my and Johan's design work, basically.
Yeah.
And so we complement each other quite well.
And so once you guys have the design work done, then you pass it over to your manufacturers?
Yeah, we do. Exactly.
Yeah.
And do all the technical drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And then
how long do the technical drawings take about?
So that is done maybe in like a month or so.
Okay.
Depending on how much... I mean, sometimes it takes longer time. Where we like have to adjust stuff mm-hmm. and maybe rethink some designs. Or
like some of the designs don't necessarily jive with the actual technical aspects of the movement. Or
Exactly. Right. So sometimes we have to work back and forth for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, we have a lot of sample rounds, especially for the dials, mm-hmm. to find the right textures and the right colors. We launched two new dial colors mm-hmm. of the BW Series 3. Model. So we have a green one and a blue one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite hard to find the right colors of, for example, the green one and the blue one.
I would say 95% of them are the wrong green and the wrong
Definitely.
Blue, and then 5% of them are the right ones. And finding those right ones is tough.
Definitely. So we had a lot of sample rounds before we got the right colors.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a long process, back and forth.
And then you guys get samples, and then... Usually, like, how many samples do you go through?
Yeah, maybe five, mm-hmm. five or six. Could be more for the dials, actually.
Yeah.
But we are quite picky mm-hmm. and really want to get it right.
Yeah.
So it's worth the extra time it takes.
So being a smaller brand, you obviously don't have the same marketing budgets that big brands do.
Mm.
How do you go about marketing your product and getting your product out there?
Yeah, that's really one of the main obstacles,
mm-hmm.
just to communicate and spread the brand awareness, basically. Being a small brand, we have to do a lot of stuff ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and we do our PR on our own as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it's really important to build a network of contacts with all the different magazines and stuff, and it's a long process as well.
Mm-hmm.
You fight with a lot of different brands,
mm-hmm.
not only watches, of course. It's of course working with like Worn and Wound and having reviews and stuff is really important for us, of course, because we can't advertise.
Mm-hmm.
It's too expensive.
Yeah.
So reviews, and I believe YouTube reviews has grown quite a lot
mm-hmm.
recently. So that's also important for us.
Yeah.
It's difficult for us to work with influencers on mm-hmm. Instagram, for example, since the watches are quite expensive. So we can't really gift mm-hmm. watches to everyone.
Yeah, and there's so many.
Yeah, there are. So it really is a challenge to build brand awareness.
Right.
And that's why it's so important for us to be on an event like Wind Up.
Mm-hmm.
To meet people and be able to show the watches in person and tell all the stories behind it, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, being an online brand, there's very few opportunities for people to come by and see your watches. So now that you're here at Windup, which is actually where we're recording this, what is some of the feedback that you're getting? I was actually sitting here in this room and you're selling right outside the room.
Yeah,
and I heard the conversations that you were having. From what I heard, very positive conversations.
It is, definitely. And some people have read about us before they come here.
Okay.
Some haven't seen us before and are quite impressed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really great to just be able to show all the details and tell all the thoughts behind the mm-hmm. design and everything. So it's really important for us. And being a small brand, the personal meeting is really important, I think.
For sure, absolutely.
And we build all our watches on order.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also a personal approach, I think, that we actually build the watch specifically for each customer.
And the watches are assembled in Sweden.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
So we have our own watchmaker doing all the assembling and testing in Sweden.
Yeah.
We try to do as much as possible in Sweden.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the watch scene in Sweden.
There are a few Swedish brands popping up now, or actually quite a lot, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all other brands, I would say, is in the Daniel Wellington. Mm-hmm.
The more like fashion.
Fashion
brand.
Watches.
Yeah.
Low priced. And I would say that most of the brands want to become a new Daniel Wellington, basically. So there aren't that many brands that have higher ambitions, so to speak.
Staying power.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we are one of the few there, but it's growing in Sweden as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we have seen some new brands starting in recent years, definitely. But the funny thing is that we mainly sell in the US.
Mm-hmm.
So Sweden is not our biggest market at all, which is a bit funny.
So what are some of, other than the US, what are some of your biggest markets?
It's Japan, UK, and we have just started working with a distributor in Malaysia as well. So that's new for us.
Yeah.
So that's also very exciting.
Do you have to approach different markets differently in terms of how you sort of present your brand?
No, I don't think so. We basically want to communicate the same message on all markets, I would say. So we are focusing on the design, of course, our Swedish design heritage, and also that we build the watches in Sweden.
Yeah,
I believe Sweden has a good reputation when it comes to production and design. It's a country famous for high-quality products, I would say. So, I mean, we try to communicate our Swedish origin and heritage.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite important for us.
Yeah. One thing that I, you know, if I were to identify about your brand, and I think it's kind of unique, and I don't think a lot of brands kind of get this, is I feel like you make watches that can appeal both to the watch nerd, but also to the regular person coming off the street that just wants a really nice looking watch. Mm. And then on top of that, it's also high quality.
Yeah.
It's, in some ways, it's sort of like, I think, what Nomos is able to do. I think it's something that like Stova is able to do, or Young Hands is able to do. Mm. It's really clean design that I think permeates a broad spectrum of tastes. Was that your approach when you were designing your watches?
Yeah, absolutely, I would say. We only make watches that we would wear ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the style we're offering is kind of a dressy style, I would say. It's a design that goes well with in many different situations.
Mm-hmm. Very versatile.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I guess that appeals to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And makes them quite wearable in many situations. You can wear it with jeans and a t-shirt or more dressed up. So I guess that makes them quite versatile.
Yeah. Now, it's funny, like my wife, she really does not care about watches.
Yeah, right.
But I'll show her, like, let's say Young Hands Max Bill.
Yeah.
And that's like a really, it's a really clean design, really sort of easy to digest. And she likes it. It's what, if you think of a watch, it's kind of what you imagine a watch to be.
Yeah.
And then I'll show her like a Rolex Submariner, which with like the watch community is like one of the most iconic watches. But to her, it's like a really weird looking thing. It's
kind
of strange. It's like, what is that? What is that bezel? You know, why is there a little like bubble magnifying the
date? Right.
That's a strange thing.
Right.
So like, you know, I think there's something to be said about clean design that's universal, but also different enough and has its own infusion of like distinct flavor, which I think you guys do really well. I think you guys make really distinct watches. Obviously, there's a minimalist aspect to them, but I think they're really unique and incomparable to anything else currently on the market.
I'm glad to hear. And that's really our ambition.
Yeah.
We don't want to in any way copy any of the big brands and the famous models.
Mm-hmm.
So we really want to go our own way and create our own design.
Yeah.
And our own identity in the design. That's very important for us.
Yeah. So can you give us a little hint at what's coming up next?
Yeah, we have some exciting things coming up.
Yeah.
It will take a while until it's launched, actually. I'm not sure I can give you too much details about it, but it's going to be, I can tell you that we will probably go smaller than the current watch.
Oh, wow.
Currently, our automatics are 39mm. Mm-hmm. So we will probably go smaller than that.
So are you seeing like a general sort of preference for smaller watches growing?
I think so. But I think it's a lot of people consider maybe 42mm being a small watch.
Right, right.
So 39 is maybe already on the smaller side.
Right.
But I think we would like to go smaller, actually. And we can see that there are quite a lot of people that want smaller watches than 39.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are realizing that watches that previously were considered smaller, maybe like 35mm, actually work in a number of different wrist sizes.
Yeah.
It's all about changing your perception of it how a watch should fit. And definitely. Obviously in like the 50s and 60s, 35, 36 millimeters, that was normal.
Exactly. You know,
even smaller was normal.
Yeah.
And it didn't look out of place. I think it's just the fact that because watch sizes had gone up for so long,
right.
that a perception of what a watch should look like was a little bit skewed. And I think we're seeing a shift back to smaller sizes now.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree. And I think it's a good shift.
Yeah.
I think it looks much nicer with a smaller watch.
I think so too. I think a watch should be discreet.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Totally. Cool. Well, Magnus, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was
a
blast. Thank you.
Thank you.
And until next time, everyone. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn and Wound Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch? A strap? Don't forget to visit the Wind Up Watch Shop. And of course, head to wornandwound.com daily for news and reviews of great wristwatches. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.